supreme talent, supreme drama. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the next hour, we look behind the songs of the most popular girl group of all time. Then, Hasidic star Matis Yahu changed the face of reggae a few years ago, topping the charts and even getting a Grammy nod. He'll play live in our studio. But first, decades before Michael Jackson danced the moonwalk and became the king of pop, three girls from the Detroit Projects became the most important American music act after Elvis. Between the years 1964 and 69, the Supremes rolled off 12 number one singles, including this one, You Keep Me Hanging On. But behind their rags-to-riches story, the group was burdened with infighting and tragedy. Mark Hrabowski is the author of the first biography of the group, The Supremes, a saga of Motown dreams, success, betrayal. He joins us here in our studio. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you, John. Well, nice being back.
This is amazing to me, first of all. I mean, among the most popular singing groups of all time, and they've been gone for decades, and only now are we getting the first biography of them. Why?
Only now are we getting the first serious biography, because they have been written about maybe more than anybody else in music through the years, but in dribs and drabs and in that celebrity fanzine gossip, you know, that highly offensive to me, sleazy journalism, you know, where they just concentrate on Diana Ross sleeping her way to the top and barely touch the music, if at all, only mentioning some titles along the way. Well, I wanted to do a lot better than that.
And of course, you know, people will sort of use Dreamgirls as a touchstone because that was
always
modeled on the Supremes.
But they should not.
Tell us why.
Because the term loosely based is made for this example. Because first of all, the original Dreamgirls, the Michael Bennett Broadway show, was about three girls from Chicago who come to New York. And, you know, that's pretty loosely based on
right.
The Supremes. The movie was much more centrally focused on the Supremes. Obviously, you had them in Detroit. You had the Gordy character. You had the Florence Ballard character. But, I mean, after all, how could that possibly be the story of the Supremes when the Florence Ballard character has the last laugh and comes back and has a triumphal closing when, in fact, the real Florence Ballard character died in obscurity, penniless, in the ghetto of Detroit.
At the age of 32.
32, yeah.
All right, so you'd say you didn't want to go that kind of celebrity journalism route because there wasn't enough focus on the music. So tell me about the Supremes. You know, what made them more than just, you know, three pretty girls from Detroit?
Yeah. Well, originally they started out as a pretty good R&B act. If anyone has ever seen the original films of the Motortown Revue, which was a bus tour that Gordy sent all his acts out on.
Berry Gordy being
Berry
the founder
Gordy,
of
Berry
Motown.
Berry Gordy, right. And they would travel the Chitlin circuit that James Brown and Ike and Tina Turner did, and they were very hardcore. When they got to the Apollo Theater, they were a hardcore R&B act. They had to be, or they'd be booed off the stage, which, in fact, the Supremes were.
I heard that the early Apollo audiences did not like the Supremes.
Because they couldn't dance. They didn't really belt out a tune the way James Brown would, obviously. This was the whole thing about 63, 64, where Motown had to make a hard decision how to go on with the Supremes, because they had nothing but failure for 3 years. Even though Smokey Robinson wrote for them and produced them, and Berry Gordy himself wrote for and produced them, they had nothing to show for it. It was until about 64 when the trio of Holland Dozier Holland, probably the most famous writing producing team in music history, got with them that the whole thing kind of switched, because they understood what they had to do was present them as three princesses of soul, not in the Martha and the Vandellas tradition of, you know, coming out and belting out songs, you know.
All right. Now, before they could get to the HDH part, the Holland Dozier Holland part, they did have to go through some lean years. And as you say, Berry Gordy had a tough decision to make about whether to stick with the Supremes. He made the decision to stick with them. And at this point, we have to get into a little bit of the celebrity journalism thing.
Yeah, and I always people who have been focusing on the, you know, Diana sleeping away to the top in review. By the way, the reviews have been spectacular. They've been great. But every once in a while, you'll see, you know, it's another book about Diana sleeping away to the top. And I have to take great umbrage at that, because I put a lot of work into this book. And, you do have to go into that. I mean, it is part of the story. They never would have achieved what they did had Diana Ross not been so ambitious and so amoral in her ambition that she would, in fact, climb her way to the top by sleeping with some very powerful men at Motown.
Including Berry Gordy, the founder.
Well, the first one was Smokey Robinson, and the second one was Brian Holland, which led to the association with Holland Dozier Holland. It never would have happened otherwise, because they were busy with Martha and the Vandellas and Marvin Gaye and other acts. And then, of course, came Berry Gordy, you know, which was the one she had her sights on the whole time, and probably she being the one he had his sights on.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you're right that he hired her as a secretary when she had absolutely no secretarial
she's
skills at all.
She's probably the worst secretary in the history of the world.
All right, so while she's slaving away at the desk, you know, at the Supremes are, you know, they're
never
in the
slaved
salt,
away at the
right,
desk.
Okay. They're in the salt mines. They're in the studio. They're cutting sides. They're not having hits. They're doing songs like Buttered Popcorn.
Yes.
Why is this not working for them?
Because they tried to fit them into the usual Motown niche, which was the early Marvelette songs, which were very, very, you know, dainty and princess-like, but very R&B at the same time. Supremes could not handle that. They were not made for that. They were much more of a pop act from the beginning, put into the wrong niche. So it just did not work. The Buttered Popcorn was a, you know, bad song. It's Berry Gordy wrote the song.
Berry Gordy wrote it.
And it was a total bomb of a song. And you never heard Florence Ballard have a lead vocal after that because it was so bad.
All right, now this is the Supremes, and as Mark Wabowski just said, this is not Diana Ross on the lead voice. This is Florence Ballard. Berry Gordy did many great things founding Motown, yeah, but writing this song was perhaps not one of them.
It was not Money or, you know, it was not Do You Love Me. This was a real bomb. It was done, you know, because neither Smokey nor Berry Gordy had any understanding of what to do with girl groups. Because he didn't want to sign the Supremes originally. He told them to go away and finish school. It was an excuse basically to get rid of them. Because they had no girl groups. They didn't know how to present girl groups. This, what you just heard, Buttered Popcorn, is derivative of, you know, Shirelles, whatever. But that's not Detroit. They had to find that medium whereby they could put those great Detroit musicians to work on a number that girls could sing but not have it sound weak and thin and drippy like that.
You mentioned Florence Ballard. You write in the book that she really was the musical talent, the most musically gifted.
At the beginning, she was, I think it's probably because she was the most aggressive at the beginning. She was the one who spoke up for the other two. I mean, Diana Ross was always ambitious and always knew what she wanted, but she was very shy at the beginning as a teenager. And Mary Wilson was always the cipher, you know, never taking an opinion either way, just, you know, not rocking the boat. Flo had to make all the decisions. And, you know, her voice was great. But her voice was great in a way that, you know, you'd want to see her at a church on a Friday night, you know, at a talent show. Whereas you would not go out and buy a record with her voice on it. And you certainly would not go buy another record with her voice on it.
Well, as was proven by the fact that the recordings were all flops,
yeah,
until Diana Ross gets in front of the center mic and this song, Where Did Our Love Go,
right,
comes out. This is 1964. What has changed here? Why is this suddenly a number one hit?
What had changed was that they were now with Holland Dozier Holland, and they had had a minor, well, actually, number 23, I don't know, what would you call a middling hit, sort of an okay hit, with When the Love Lights Start Shining Through His Eyes, which was a great Holland Dozier Holland production, but a little bit too fat and sassy, a little bit too overdone. But it was a number 23 hit. And for them, that was everything. And got them on the Dick Clark caravan over the summer of 64, which was a great, great advantage for them. Again, why Gordy would do that for a group that was unsuccessful, you know, I mean, it had to do with Diana Ross. It had to do with the fact that she had him wrapped around her finger even before they were successful. So they go on the Dick Clark caravan. While they're on the tour, the song, which they hated, by the way, Where Did Our Love Go becomes number one. It becomes the top song in the country.
If they hated it, who convinced them to record it?
Oh, they had no choice. You know, I've heard stories about Where Did Our Love Go, that it was given to the Marvelettes first, and they turned it down, so it went to the Supreme. What a preposterous notion that is. These people in Motown were like interchangeable parts. They had no opinion in the matter. They didn't have any controlling authority about what songs they were going to sing. They were just given a song, and they went in and recorded it. But it was true that they hated this song because they didn't think it was anything special. They thought it was repetitive, boring nonsense. But in the ears of Holland Dozier Holland, it was a hit right from the start. And I asked them, because I interviewed them for the book of the two Holland brothers, and they said, no, we wrote that for Diana. We wrote that for the Supremes. Because we had to find that medium where, if you listen to Diana's voice on this, it's very diaphanous. It's very, you can almost reach through it. That was the quality that they sensed about her that they needed to really play up.
Is the Supremes and Where Did Our Love Go? It went to number one in 1964, the first of 12 number one singles for the Supremes. And we're speaking with Mark Hrabowski, author of the book The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, Betrayal. And you've mentioned a couple of times, you know, Diana with Berry Gordy sort of wrapped around her finger, you know, sleeping with him from kind of a fairly early age.
Well, it happened in 65.
So if he's wrapped around her finger, who's calling the shots then for the Supremes by this point, by 64, 65?
Well, I mean, it's still Gordy and Holland Dozier Holland. You know, they're coming up with the songs and taking them in, and they were under tremendous pressure after. They had the first five. After Love Light, the five in a row after that became number one. I mean, it just, if you consider that, it's just an astonishing feat. Only the Beatles had done that, or would do that, five in a row, six in a row, and Elvis. And it was just an incredible pressure. Imagine they had to come up with even better songs each time while still producing and writing for the Four Tops and Marvin Gaye and other acts. This was an unbelievable factory
right. In
Motown.
And Holland Dozier Holland, really one of the big wheels, one of the big cogs in this factory there in Detroit.
Until they left town, yeah, or left Gordy.
Mark Hrabowski is my guest. The book is The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, Betrayal. So it starts in Motown. It stays in Motown for most of the story. Tell us a little bit about is it truly a Cinderella story? Three girls from the projects who hit it big?
In a sense it is, but what Motown tried to fableize, if I can make up a word, is that there were three close friends from childhood in the ghetto growing up together becoming triple princesses, I guess, you know. In fact, they barely knew each other as kids. They knew each other a little bit as teenagers, even though they lived in the projects. There were about 50,000 people in the Brewster Projects. And they did not go to the same schools, and they did not sing with each other until they were put together by this hustler slash pimp slash music entrepreneur named Milt Jenkins, who, like Berry Gordy and other people like that at the time, were prowling the streets looking for music acts to sign so they could ride a dream somehow to fame and fortune. And he put them together, but it was Mary and Flo who came in together for an audition to Milton Jenkins. And when they got there, it was the fourth girl put together for the group, Betty McClown, who brought Diana in. It's sort of a mystery how that happened, because the way Diana and Mary have told it in their own autobiography through the years, it's totally different stories. They don't know it. They can't get their story straight.
Well, all right, so I have to ask you this then. Yeah. I mean, my first question to you is why there hasn't been like a serious biography of this group until now. There have been all these autobiographies,
right,
which are fairly whitewashed. how do you know?
Diana's a horrible. She doesn't. It seems like she can't remember last week. This woman.
So where do you get all? I mean, how? Where are you getting the primary source material from?
You've got to walk the streets, you know? You've got to go back and talk to people who have been long out of the public eye. Very interesting talking to some of the members of the Vandellas and the Marvelettes, because these are the people who hated Diana Ross even before she was popular. Because even before she was popular, she had run-ins with all of them. She almost ran over Gladys Horton, the lead singer of the Marvelettes, in a parking lot one night. And this is not an exaggeration.
Was it an accident?
And even worse or better for the story, Gladys was leading a blind boy across the parking lot. It's almost like you couldn't make this up. It wasn't Stevie Wonder, by the way. Leading a blind boy across the parking lot. And Diana was so peeved at her that she got into a car, gunned it, and it was coming right at her. Just happened to stop about 5 feet short, you know. It's a very famous story.
Okay.
So they hated her. She hated them. And, you know, the other two Supremes got along fine with the other girl group acts at Motown.
And you know, obviously Flo is long gone, but what about Mary? I mean, were you able to talk to her about...
No, I didn't want to. I really didn't. Because Mary, you know, she said what she had to say in two books, Dream Girl and the follow-up to that. And the first one was a big bestseller. It was done on one premise and one premise alone, and being a writer, I could imagine how it was sold to the editor. I'm going to rip Diana Ross to shreds. Give me the money. Because it started on page one, and it didn't let up for 200 pages after that. And when you read these women's stories, you see gaping holes in them that need to be filled. Mary doesn't remember a lot either. She had to go into an analysis to be able to remember some of what happened. Because it's a very painful thing to look back on that era for Mary. And if Flo is alive today, it would be scarifying to look back on that era, what happened to her. I mean, she what happened to her was the shame of Motown, you know.
She was, you write that she was, you know, eventually sort of cast out. She was given a check for a healthy $140,000,
yeah,
not an inconsiderable sum in those days.
She was, except she never saw any of it. It went to this lawyer who stole it all. But she was actually due probably about $1.6 million. That's how much the Supremes had earned for Gordy. $1.6 million for Florence. You know, they split it equally.
At that point.
Yeah, until Diana left. Imagine being owed $1.6 million and getting $140 and having to, like, settle for it and being happy to settle for it. I don't know how he was able to get away with that kind of stuff, but he did.
Well, that's part of the explanation for the subtitle of the book, The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, and Betrayal. Mark Hrabowski is the author. He's my guest on Soundcheck. And coming up in a moment, more of our conversation about The Supremes. And a little bit later on, we'll change gears musically when Matis Yahu, the Hasidic rap reggae sensation, performs live in our studio and talks about his remarkable personal journey on Soundcheck. Pop on the outside, scathing scandal on the inside. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we're back with Mark Hrabowski, author of The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, Betrayal. Before the break, Mark, you were talking about Flo Ballard, you know, getting less than a tenth of what she was owed, being cast out of the Motown family, basically replaced by Diana Ross years before that as the central figure of The Supremes. I mean, her story is ostensibly part of the Dream Girls myth. And as you said before, that really is a myth. Give us the reality of what happened to Flo Ballard.
They nailed it, you know, on the general outline, you know, that she was too fat and that she was too sassy and talked back. But it's a much more delicate story than that. Flo Ballard was a very unhappy woman, a very unhappy girl. Just when the Supremes were taking off, had not yet made it big, she was raped. She was date raped one night. And, you know, this was a different era for, you know, women had to sort of keep that all bottled up inside. Nothing could be done about it. Although they said her family took care of it, you know, with ghetto justice because, you know, the police wouldn't do anything. But this lingered with her for years, and it ate into her entire confidence. She was always very outgoing before that. She turned very inward, very almost, you know, off in a world of her own. And once she was replaced by Diana as the lead vocalist, it blended along with all her other insecurities and you know, demons, and it just ate at her like battery acid. And she would do anything to cross Gordy. It was almost like, you know, she'd see what she could get away with because she knew Gordy wanted her. Gordy did want her out probably as early as 65, 66. He wanted her out. He didn't think her image meshed with the Cinderella, you know, the mascara and the taffeta, the whole chiffon, you know, the whole thing, the wigs. Because Flo was not that type. She just wanted to get on stage and belt. She didn't want to. Mm-hmm. She didn't want to do hi-hat dance routines on the Ed Sullivan Show.
The group was, I mean, and then there was also drug and alcohol abuse.
Well, yes, and she hit the bottle starting about 65, 66. What really happened, I think, that what blew her fuse was when they made it to the Copacabana, which was Gordy's great dream for his stable, for somebody in his stable to play the Copacabana, the center of cool, hip, white mainstream entertainment in the 50s and 60s. They made it there, but during the run, they took away Flo's only lead vocal that she sang on stage, which was People, the Barbra Streisand People, you know. Mm-hmm. That was her pride and joy. It was the only thin reed left of the influence she had. They took that away from her, and she lost it. She ran out on a rehearsal. She ran down the streets of New York through traffic without stopping for lights. Could have been run over. And from that day on, it was just impossible to reconcile the differences she had with Gordy. And it was like a game of chicken the rest of the way, which she could not possibly win.
And eventually, you know, she's replaced by Cindy Birdsong. And the Supremes continue, and I think probably a lot of people watching the Ed Sullivan Show or whatever had no idea that there had been a replacement.
Isn't that amazing? It's, you know... I say in the book, and I truly believe it, that Berry Gordy is the luckiest man on the face of the earth, Lou Gehrig notwithstanding. He is blessed doubly, triply, whatever. Everything he ever did was either based on genius or dumb luck because he got away with a figurative murder there in Motown. And he replaced Flo with a lookalike, Cindy Birdsong, who looked just like Flo. And was a good singer of her own. Oh, that didn't matter. She wasn't on a single record that was released as a single by the Supremes. There were other backup singers.
So, Love Child, who's singing? This is not Flo. This is post-Flo Ballard.
Love Child is the first post-Holland Dozier Holland record that they needed desperately to get a number one or a top, you know, charting record to keep the role going. Birdsong had replaced Ballard. Gordy had assembled this thing he called the Clan, this writing and producing group, which he took from L.A. and Detroit, and they put together this thing called Love Child, which was brilliant. I mean, and it was socially aware. Holland Dozier Holland, when they heard it, said, is that one of ours? Because the beat was the Holland Dozier Holland beat, and it went to number one, and it was their biggest selling record of all time. But the background singers were not Mary Wilson and not Cindy Birdsong. It was the Andantes, which was the Motown house backup, you know, the female backup group.
And yet, it was marketed as the Supremes. Yeah. Love Child was a number one hit in 1968 for allegedly the Supremes.
Allegedly, right.
So it's basically just Diana Ross and the House backup singers there.
Yeah, well,
Motown.
The last 3 years, every record that was recorded, the priority was to see if it would could be a Diana Ross solo record, because Gordy knew he was going to take Diana Ross solo. He didn't know how and when, but he wanted this store of records that he could come back to.
So was the change from Diana Ross and the Supremes to just Diana Ross a purely semantic change? Had she been going solo the last 3 years anyway?
Yeah. It was basically Diana Ross solo, moonlighting with the Supremes for the last 2 years. And it was all in the planning. I mean, Shelley Berger, who was their manager then and her manager still now, said, you know, listen, I was brought in 67. To me, the Supremes with Diana Ross and two backup singers. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes a little bit deeper than that. I mean, you know, the early records, certainly the Flo and Mary backgrounds was an essential component of those records, the way they meshed together. But later on, it didn't matter. It didn't matter.
Well, with the advantage of, you know, 20, 30 years of hindsight, was it a good decision for Diana Ross to go solo, to leave?
Oh, yeah, it was time. The Supremes, the fact that they were able to get those two final number ones, Love Child and Someday We'll Be Together, which was a total accident, by the way. It wasn't even meant for Diana Ross or the Supremes. Again, there's that luck of Berry Gordy. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the perfect denouement to the whole thing. After 9 years, it was time. It was time. Amazingly, they carried on without Diana Ross, and in a way that actually was more Supremes-like when you look at the original mission of the Supremes than it ever was with Ross.
Well, now, of course, Diana Ross is back in the news this week because of being named as the kind of the secondary caregiver of Michael Jackson's children in Jackson's will.
Don't hold your breath. Don't hold your breath for that.
Well, what kind of state? I mean, you said she doesn't even seem to remember any of this stuff. I mean, what kind of state is she in today, far as you can tell?
Well, I mean, she's still performs and still sells out, but doesn't have hit records. And she's still with Motown now after coming back to them after being away for a while. But, I mean, she's over, basically. I mean, she's an oldies act. A lot of people love her. But don't look for this Michael Jackson. I mean, they probably didn't even speak with each other more than five times since The Wiz, you know. This is like, you know, showbiz nonsense. The whole Jackson 5, Diana Ross thing was a farce to begin with. She was put, you know, the whole thing was meant to chip off her popularity, you know.
And to sort of jumpstart his popularity.
That's exactly what it was.
The book is called The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, Betrayal, and Post-Supremes. Of course, this song was a big hit for Diana Ross back in 1980, continued having number ones for a while after leaving the Supremes. Author Mark Rabowski, good to have you back on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Great. See you next time.
Up next, reggae rapper Matis Yahoo and his band preview the new upcoming album Light live in our studio. And tomorrow on the show, your cheating heart. Infidelity may be the bane of modern politics, but it's good for music. We'll look at the best cheating songs tomorrow on Soundcheck.